This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 3rd of June, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, rockets strike the presidential compound in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, reportedly injuring the president and prime minister. Off Tunisia's coast, more than 150 people drown after a boat carrying many hundreds of refugees capsizes.
I lost a lot of things, all my life savings. I lost a brother, a friend, you understand, most families.
And we'll examine the upcoming trial of Thomas Drake, the whistleblower and former National Security Agency executive who's charged with violating the Espionage Act.
An archaic law that's 93 years old and meant to go after spies, not whistleblowers.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Tens of thousands of people are protesting today in Syria, despite security forces opening fire on groups of demonstrators. Media reports say that more than 30 people died today in the city of Hama alone. Organizers called today's protest, Friday of the Children of Freedom, to mark the deaths of dozens of children who have been killed by state security forces and government supporters since anti-government protests broke out. MSNBC reports the government has shut down most internet access within the country. Data from internet monitoring firm Renesas shows that 40 of about 60 available Syrian networks became unavailable within a one-hour period this morning. This covers much of the 3G and DSL service available in the country. A national postal worker strike kicked off in Canada today, with the union pushing for safer working conditions and more job security. The strike began at midnight in Winnipeg when the Canada Post Corporation rejected the final contract offer from the Canada Union of Postal Workers, or CUPW. Rotating strike actions will be happening across the country until a new contract is reached for the union's 50,000 members. The postal workers have been without contracts since last January. Canada Post has rejected the union's demand for a wage increase, pointing out that letter mail has fallen by 17% since 2006, and that a wage increase would lead to billions of dollars in deficit. Ruth Breen, a postal worker with a CUPW local in New Brunswick, spoke to FSRN's Aaron Lakoff, saying she rejected that reasoning.
We're challenging them that we can only really find a 7% decline. What CUPW would like to do is work with Canada Post and find ways to use the infrastructure of people and buildings that Canada Post has and expand services to meet the needs of Canadians now and the communities and the neighborhoods that we're servicing.
The last postal strike in Canada was in 1997 and was ended by a piece of back-to-work legislation. The current Stephen Harper government has not indicated if it would consider similar legislation to end the strike. The Labor Department today announced the official U.S. unemployment rate for May is 9.1%, ticking up one-tenth from the April rate. The real U.S. unemployment number moved down slightly to 15.8%. That number includes workers marginally attached to the workforce and those working part-time for economic reasons. Former Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards was indicted today by a federal grand jury. Charges brought by the U.S. Justice Department allege that Edwards conspired to violate campaign finance laws by concealing donations of $900,000 used to cover up an extramarital affair he was having with a campaign worker. He was scheduled to appear in court this afternoon. Alabama has passed immigration legislation requiring businesses to verify all their employees are legally allowed to work in the U.S. The Arizona-style law also allows police to check immigration papers during traffic stops. In other immigration news, civil rights groups have filed suit against the state of Georgia, challenging its recently passed immigration law. The groups, which include the ACLU, the Asian Law Caucus, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and the National Immigrant Law Center, says the so-called Show Me Your Papers law is unconstitutional. An ACLU attorney says Georgia should be prepared for the courts to block the law, as they have for similar Arizona and Utah statutes. And finally, Jack Kevorkian, the doctor and right-to-die activist, has died of complications related to kidney problems. The 83-year-old was a champion of physician-assisted suicide for terminally ill patients. In 2009, he gave a lecture at Pennsylvania's Kutztown University. There, he said he believed the public would eventually force the American Medical Association to endorse the practice.
It's got to be a medical service declared ethical by the AMA, and then the doctors will get together and set the rules, like we do with every medical procedure. There no one tells you how to do a kidney transplant or a heart transplant. No law that tells you when it should be done. These are all medical decisions between doctor and patient. But no one complains. You don't hear a peep. Well, I got more than a peep.
Kevorkian assisted in the suicides of more than 100 people. He served 8 years in prison from 1999 to 2007 for a second-degree murder conviction. Kevorkian's Right to Die campaign and work led to two states, Oregon in 1994 and Washington in 2008, legalizing the act. The Montana Supreme Court also ruled that the state constitution does not prohibit physician-assisted suicide. But Kevorkian said even those laws don't do it right because they don't allow a doctor to be present at the time of death. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Yemen today, rockets fired into the presidential palace reportedly wounded President Ali Abdullah Saleh. The prime minister and other officials were also injured and several guards killed. Fighting is escalating in the Yemeni capital Sana'a between security forces and tribesmen led by Sadek al-Ammar, who supports the call by protesters for President Saleh to step down. According to the BBC, al-Ammar has denied carrying out the attack. Amal al-Basha, chairperson of the Arab Sisters Forum for Human Rights, lives in Sana'a. She described the situation in the city to Al Jazeera.
There have been clashes and bombing everywhere in the city. Before, it was only restricted to Al-Hasaba area, the neighborhood of Sheikh Al-Ahmar. But for tonight and yesterday, fighting and firing were everywhere. We have been hearing a lot of shots, sometimes with rifles, sometimes with heavy weapons. It's very strong. 2 hours ago, I have been counting the number of the strong bombing. It was like 25 times I was hearing very strong explosions.
Bashar said that food is becoming scarce in the city and many people are starting to leave the capital to escape the violence. In the southern city of Taiz, anti-government protests by many thousands of people against the regime continued. In a video uploaded to YouTube, said to be from the city's Sapa Harin neighborhood, many hundreds of people sing, dance, and wave flags. The United Nations has said dozens of people have been killed and hundreds injured in recent days because of intensified use of force by the Yemeni regime against anti-government protesters. The UN said it's received reports that more than 50 people were killed and hundreds injured this week in Taiz by Yemeni security forces who destroyed a protest camp in the city using water cannons, bulldozers, and live ammunition. As the violence in Yemen intensifies, U.S. Envoy John Brennan is in the Middle East for talks with Arab leaders about how to solve the conflict. At least 150 people, including some women and children, have drowned and scores remain missing after a boat carrying up to 850 people capsized off the Tunisian coast Wednesday afternoon. Tunisian coast guards rescued nearly 600 refugees on board. The UN Refugee Agency says this is one of the worst incidents in the Mediterranean so far this year. Most of the rescued migrants have been taken to a refugee camp along the Tunisian-Libyan border, where Marin Olivezi met some of them.
All afternoon, refugees have been lining up to check in at the International Red Cross camp. 380 rescued migrants were taken here today, adding to the 200 brought yesterday. Still shocked, some could barely talk.
I lost a lot of things, all my life savings. I lost a brother, a friend, you understand, most families. But right now, I'm really stressed up, you understand me? I lose so many things that I don't have enough strength to talk now, maybe tomorrow.
Another migrant, Arun from Nigeria, explains that the overcrowded boat left Tripoli on Saturday. Its motor broke down, then it ran aground a sandbank.
We are on top of the sea for good 5 days, just in one place. The ship cannot go front nor back. So even the children, they are dizzy. No food, no water. That's what happened.
The rescue spanned 2 days. Strong wind slowed down the operations, and no large boat could get them all at once because the seabed wasn't deep enough. Mustaza from Pakistan says the boat was old and there was no experienced captain to navigate. But he found out about all this too late.
Before not see it. We don't know before it's old boat and it's not good. They take us in small boat in sea. Then they say us go in this boat. There was no choice for come back.
Mustaza says a Tunisian fisherman who was taking part in the rescue operations took him on and saved his life. He was lucky. As rescue operations were going on and while hundreds were still on board, the boat capsized. John says he saved his 3 children 10 minutes before it was too late.
I rescued my children before the boat capsized.
Some survivors said they knew the risks of the journey, but the situation in Tripoli was worsening by the day. The trip was also expensive. Victor paid $1,600 for his family to get out of Tripoli.
Every day there was bomb. There was bomb. Even the next house before my house I live, there was a bomb that night that would make me left the next day.
To decide to left instantly
the next day. Our life was in risk.
The Organization for International Migration says 1 in 10 migrants fleeing Libya by sea die in the journey. Marine Olivesi, FSRN, Shusha, Tunisia.
In Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives voted on 2 resolutions today condemning President Obama's decision to go into Libya without asking Congress for approval or officially declaring war. Lawmakers defeated a measure from Ohio's Dennis Kucinich that would have required an end to U.S. involvement in the Libyan war, but passed a more conservative resolution offered by House Speaker John Boehner. Alice Olstein reports.
Kucinich, a longtime voice against militarism, introduced a bipartisan resolution calling for the removal of U.S. armed forces from Libya within 15 days.
Our loyalty to NATO and to our president, regardless of party affiliation, does not trump our loyalty to the United States Constitution.
The measure was up for a floor vote on Wednesday, but Speaker Boehner pulled it at the last minute. A senior staffer told the news site Politico the GOP leadership feared it was popular enough to pass. Boehner offered his own non-binding resolution the next day, requiring the White House to justify why it did not seek congressional approval for the war, to explain the military and political objectives, and to provide a cost estimate. It also prohibits the Pentagon from sending ground troops to Libya, though airstrikes could continue. Jim McGovern of Massachusetts criticized the Boehner resolution during the floor debate, saying it merely sends a partisan message and has no teeth.
We could do a press release, and it would have the same impact that the resolution that Mr. Boehner has introduced would have on the President of the United States and on forcing the President of the United States to do certain things. I want to again emphasize that there is a war powers resolution, it is law, and we have a role in that. And what Mr. Kucinich is trying to do is to assert the proper congressional role.
Boehner shot back that the Kucinich proposal to pull troops is hasty and possibly dangerous.
The resolution offered by my colleague from Ohio, Mr. Kucinich, conveys the concerns of the American people, but it also mandates a precipitous withdrawal from our role in supporting our NATO allies in Libya. In my opinion, that would undermine our troops and our allies, which could have serious consequences for our broader national security. In my view, the gentleman's resolution goes too far.
Kucinich countered by citing President Obama's own claims that the U.S. role in Libya is limited. If that's true, he says,
then there should be no difficulty in pulling out of Libya in 15 days. And if there is, we need to start asking questions about how deeply enmeshed we are if our participation is truly no boots on the ground.
The War Powers Resolution of 1973 requires Congress to approve a military operation within 60 days. 76 days have passed since the Libya war began, and NATO recently announced an extension of the mission until September. According to Defense Secretary Robert Gates, the Libya war has cost the U.S. over $750 million, much more than originally anticipated. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The trial of whistleblower Thomas Drake, a former National Security Agency executive, is due to begin on June 13. Drake is charged with violating the Espionage Act by retaining classified information and could face up to 35 years in prison. But Drake says the information he gave reporters was about waste and mismanagement at the NSA, and he didn't know it was classified. In April, Drake defended his actions during a speech to accept the Ridenour Prize for truth-telling.
Truth tellers such as myself are those who are simply doing their jobs and honoring their oaths to serve their nation under the law of the land. We are dedicated to the proposition that government service is of, for, by the people.
Sound courtesy of Democracy Now. Drake was presented with the Ridenour Prize by Jeslyn Raddick, Homeland Security and Human Rights Director for the whistleblowing organization, the Government Accountability Project. Raddick is a former ethics advisor to the United States Department of Justice, who also came to prominence as a whistleblower after she disclosed that the FBI violated the civil rights of John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban. For more on the Drake case, she joins us now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Thomas Drake? Who is he exactly, and what was he trying to expose?
Thomas Drake was a former senior executive at the National Security Agency, and he was trying to expose gross waste, mismanagement, and illegality that was going on in the agency with regard to a secret domestic spying program.
And what channels did he use to try and release this information?
He actually used all the so-called proper internal channels that whistleblowers are supposed to use. He complained to his bosses, to the NSA General Counsel, to the Department of Defense Inspector General, to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, and to the Department of Defense Inspector General, which conducted a 2.5-year investigation that ultimately vindicated the concerns of Mr. Drake and a handful of his colleagues.
And yet he's been charged. He's going on trial. What exactly is he charged with, and how did he come to be charged?
Basically, after the publication of the Pulitzer Prize-winning story in the New York Times regarding the illegal warrantless wiretapping that was going on in 2005, that was how he initially got kind of caught up in the web of targets when they were looking for whoever leaked or whoever served as a source for that story. But obviously his case is far removed and morphed from anything having to do with that. He was never a source for the New York Times. He did not leak to classified information to a reporter or to anyone, and he is not charged with leaking. Instead, he is charged under the Espionage Act, an archaic law that's 93 years old and meant to go after spies, not whistleblowers. And he's charged with retention, in other words, retaining information that the government has alleged is classified. So it's a very odd thing. He was only the fourth case in U.S. history where the Espionage Act has been used to try someone for supposedly mishandling classified information. The first case, tellingly, was that of Dan Ellsberg.
Is there a double standard here? It seems that when anonymous government officials leak information, it's okay, but when whistleblowers do it, it's illegal.
Absolutely. You know, no one is prosecuting Bob Woodward, and he leaked high-level sources and methods in his book, in numerous books, actually, and no one's going after him. And the White House routinely engages in what are called authorized leaks, which is sort of an oxymoron if leaks are supposed to be somehow improper. So the government leaks like a sieve when it's convenient for the government to do so. Yet Obama, more than any president in history, has targeted public servants who have tried to blow the whistle on illegal activity and called them leakers instead of whistleblowers, and is charging them under the Espionage Act rather as the public servants of conscience and high standards that they are.
Why is it, do you think, that the Obama administration has pursued these leakers of information so aggressively?
It's perplexing. I wish I could give you a reason that made sense, and it's hard to come up with one. I fear, unfortunately, the worst, which is that this is really a backdoor way of creating an official secrets act rather than just trying to legislate one. We don't have such a law in this country, and I think this case has the potential to make really bad law and form really bad precedent that will haunt the country for decades and possibly centuries to come.
It's hard to talk about whistleblowing and not think of Private Bradley Manning. Where do you think his case fits into all this?
Manning's not being charged under the Espionage Act, but kind of under its evil twin, in aiding the enemy. He kind of did the opposite of what Drake did. Drake complained through internal channels, whereas Manning went directly to a media outlet. Clearly, Bradley Manning exposed a lot of stuff that evidenced war crimes, namely the indiscriminate killing of innocent civilians for sport, as if it was a video game. But there also were a number of State Department cables. Now, I haven't heard the U.S. detail how that has done any harm to national security. I think it has, like in the Drake case, shown evidence that is embarrassing to the United States. So there are some parallels, but there are very, very, very important differences. Also, Thomas Drake never disclosed anything, much less anything that was classified. And for better or for worse, with Manning, there do happen to be those issues of disclosure and of classified, high-level classified documents. And that's not an issue with Drake.
Jesslyn Raddick, Homeland Security and Human Rights Director for the whistleblowing organization, the Government Accountability Project. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
An edgy feminist initiative called Slut Walks is quickly becoming an international phenomenon, with marches tomorrow in Chicago and Los Angeles. It first started in Toronto, and since then women have been coming out in the streets in large numbers to denounce rape, sexual assault and victim blaming. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal, where a recent march took place.
I'm not asking for it until I do.
I'm not asking for it until I do.
Slut revolution.
Slut revolution.
Hundreds of people took to the streets of Montreal on Sunday, dressed in colorful outfits, some of them revealing. Participants held signs reading, "My body, my choice," and "A dress is not a yes." This was the seventh slut walk to have taken place in Canada since April, and others are scheduled throughout the summer in cities across the United States, Australia, South Africa, and Argentina. While there are no specific political demands for the series of events, they are intended to raise awareness around sexual assault and the notion of victim blaming, or when people blame the woman for her own assault or rape. Although victim blaming has been an issue for decades, anger was building following a comment made last January by Toronto Police Constable Michael Sanguinetti. At a York University public forum, Sanguinetti said that, quote, "women should avoid dressing like sluts in order to not be victimized." Toronto resident Heather Jarvis said that comment inspired her to take action.
When I heard about the Toronto police officers' comments through media, I was livid. So we decided to create Slut Walk and get into action and pick up the word that the police officer used against us and throw it back at them.
According to the Toronto Star newspaper, Constable Sanguinetti later apologized for his remarks. But many women say there's a growing climate of legitimizing gender violence in Canada. Some point to a Winnipeg judge's decision last February, which gave a convicted rapist a conditional sentence with no jail time. His justification? The survivor's clothing, makeup, and flirtatious behavior were to blame for the attack.
A dress is not a yes!
A dress is revenge is always sexy!
Among those out for the slut walk in Montreal were sex workers, who say they are often the victims of sexual aggression, yet receive little sympathy from the police. Émilie Laliberté is the executive director of Stella, an advocacy group by and for sex workers in Montreal.
Because right now, I mean, we don't have protection, and the fact that we have a criminal status is like an open call for aggressors. You know, you can go and rape sex workers, they don't have protection, and a lot of aggression take place right now.
Soliciting prostitution remains illegal in Canada, despite a ruling at the Ontario Superior Court last September, which struck down a previous law criminalizing brothels. Sex worker advocates were hoping that decision would open up the doors for cross-country decriminalization, but the Stephen Harper Conservative government has instead been in favor of even stronger laws and enforcement against prostitution. Not all feminists in Canada have been fully supportive of slut walks. Some have criticized the movement for not reaching out to women of color or female immigrants. Harsha Walia is a writer and activist with the group No One Is Illegal in Vancouver.
We're seeing an attack particularly on Muslim women for not being liberated enough because women are perceived as covering up against their choice, right? So the niqab is seen as inherently oppressive. Because it's seen as not sex positive or not seen as sexy enough. And so for me, the critique of slut walk is that it really excluded certain kinds of feminism and fixated really around ideas of white feminist choice in terms of attire without looking at more systemic issues around sexual assault.
Slut walk organizers say they encourage participants to dress comfortably, and at many marches, both men and women wear ordinary clothes. Supporters say no matter what people wear, their main message is that a form of dress is not consent. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
And now a correction to a story we aired on May 10th concerning a study by environmental scientists from Duke University linking methane in drinking water to natural gas drilling. We interviewed Professor Rob Jackson about his study and introduced him incorrectly, saying he was from Drake University rather than Duke University. FSRN regrets the error. And that's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.